Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. Steve Platt, you're amazing. What's new, Pussycat? Joining me now, my favorite veterinarian in Los Angeles, the great Dr. Quan Stewart. Quan, thanks so much for getting up early to be with us.
Hey, thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
We met because of my cat, Sophie. Your kindness, your compassion. Boy, did you pick the right field to go in, and your mom and dad raised you right to have such a big heart. And I want to thank you publicly. And
what,
getting to know you has been unbelievable because it just continues. So let's learn first a little bit about you. What did your mom and dad do for a living? Where'd you grow up? And how did the idea of becoming a vet come to you?
So mom and dad, I grew up sort of a small town boy. I'm from New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting, though, I guess, to back up just a bit. I don't remember California or Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get to that in a minute. But I was born in L.A. Because mm-hmm. my father played for the Los Angeles Rams for a brief period, about a year and a half before he got traded and we moved on. But he was one of the first black players to ever play at the university, or one of the first black players to get recruited at the University of New Mexico. And this is going back late 60s.
Wow.
And then got picked up by the Rams after school. He had just met my mom. My mom was all 20 years old at the time. I think my dad was 22. They had a little Quan out in L.A. when he was playing. He was off at a game, I think, playing at the time. And then shortly after, he had a very brief career due to some injuries, and we moved back to Albuquerque, and that's where I grew up. High school, undergrad, eventually went on to Colorado State. Mom was a banker, and dad was a teacher PE coach, and they were great to me. And so, you know, you asked me, Doc, what inspired me to become a vet? And it's a question we get a lot. You know, I'd say next to, hey, Doc, why is my cat or dog vomiting? Or, you know, why are they scooting? Or, you know, why do they have diarrhea? I get asked a lot, why did you want to be a vet? And when did you know? And for me, it happened in one moment.
Hmm.
And you're going to like this because it speaks to L.A. and Hollywood. I was in a film with my mother when I was 7.
Hmm.
And we went in, and I was glued to the screen. That's hard for a 7-year-old to sit still, right? For 2 hours, I was just enamored and laughed, and I cried. And when I walked out of the theater, I was holding my mom's hand, and I looked up at her, and I said, Mom, when I grow up, I want to be an animal doctor. And that was the moment for me.
What was the movie?
The movie was The Black Stallion.
Wow.
One of my favorites still. Yeah.
I got to see that movie now.
Yeah, that majestic black horse and that boy, the relationship they had, I knew at that moment. And I've always loved animals. Yeah, I've been around animals my whole life. My parents, mom, dad, dogs, and mom had a working ranch for a while with cattle and horses, and so they've always been a part of my life.
You know, it's to me, maybe you can speak to this better than me. First of all, Leonardo da Vinci spent the latter part of his life on Earth trying to discover and analyze and understand the things in life that are invisible. And so he spent all this time, I mean, he was not only an artist, but he was a scientist. He was fascinated by wind. He was fascinated by the tides of the ocean. The stuff that was invisible, the forces that were out there, this is what he spent that invisible part of life. And I almost feel that there's the pet owner, there's the pet, two tangible things that are in the room. But in the room is this third thing, which is this bond that is something electric, something special. They call it love, but it's beyond that. There's this electronic thing that's between the owner and the pet. Am I onto something here, or you see it every day, or am I crazy?
No, you're far from crazy, and you know it. You know it because you felt it with your own pet, with Sophie, and I see it play out, you know, every day. I've been a vet for 22 years now, and While we can't see it with our eyes, mm-hmm. it's as much there as those things you described, like love and compassion, happiness, those emotions, yeah, they do feel very tangible to me when I see it in the room, or I'm treating a pet or I'm returning a pet to their owner after we've saved them. You see it, you feel it, and you know it exists.
Mm. You know, as an orthopedic surgeon, I just love fixing people and having them walk again and use their arms again. I just love the machinery. But what I, after 30 years of doing it, what I then love is how they can return to those intangibles of their life, being with their family, enjoying getting up in the morning and seeing the sunrise, being able to live their life because I fixed the machinery. That's the real joy of being a veterinarian, an orthopedic surgeon, and just being someone who recognizes that there's more going on here than what we actually can see. It's what we can feel. Tell us about your work in Hollywood and making sure animals are protected when they make TV shows and films.
Yeah, so, I guess to take one quick step back, I, out of school, and I went to school at Colorado State and graduated in 97, I knew I always wanted to practice somewhere on the beach. It was my dream to get out of the high desert and get to the beach. So I just picked San Diego as my spot on the map, and after school I packed up my old Mustang and drove straight to San Diego without a job back in 97, and that's where my new journey sort of began. And I bounced around. You do that as an associate vet early on in your career. I did emergency and triage for a while. Then I was an associate vet, and you just work your way up the chain. And then I managed a group of hospitals, and I was a shelter vet for a while. And that, I'll tell you, so prior to coming and working the Hollywood program, I was a shelter vet for 5 years, and I really credit that with shaping a lot of my convictions.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working in San Diego and parts of L.A. and worked for a time in Monterey, all these people had money, and it's a much easier job to save someone's pet when they have this bottomless bank account and they can just write a check for whatever needs to be done. But when everything's on the line and the owner doesn't have any resources, but you can save that animal, if they had means, but you can't, that is the hardest part of my job. I saw that a lot as a shelter vet. We saw a lot of strays. We saw a lot of low-income people. I was working in the Central Valley up in Modesto. I was a county veterinarian. It's really just a glorified shelter vet. And as such, you run the shelter and I hate to touch on euthanasia here. I don't want it to be a downer, but, by 9, 10 a.m. in the morning, we would euthanize, 50, 60 pets, every day. And a lot of them very healthy. And just dropped off at the shelter because at the time the economy was bad. This is back during the housing bust. And it broke me after a while. I was able to do it for 5 years, but I learned a lot. I took away a lot from the job and realized there's more than just, the average pet owner who has the means to take care of their pet. So fast forward, after 5 years of doing that, I realized that compassion fatigue is a real thing. And I almost reversed course. There was an opening for this position to run the Hollywood program, the No Animals Were Harmed. So a lot of us are familiar with No Animals Were Harmed during the making of this film. You'll see the credit during the end credit crawl if animals appeared in the film. So this program has been around for 75 years.
Wow.
And yeah, they actually never, Dr. Clapper, they've never had a veterinarian run the unit. So around for 75 years on, thousands, really by this point, tens of thousands of projects, and they cover anything that has animals in filmed media. So motion pictures, episodics, commercials. Anytime you see a cute little puppy in a Budweiser commercial, there is a safety rep from this program there to be a voice for the animal, to make sure they get the breaks. They're not overworked. They're not sick or injured. They're not forced to do crazy outlandish stunts and put their health at risk. So there is someone there that speaks on behalf of the animal. Whatever animal it is, in whatever type of filmed media that you're watching. The exception would be reality TV. We don't do a lot of reality TV because they don't bring us on, because they know they wouldn't be certified. They just, you know, some of the things that are done in reality TV with animals today aren't completely copacetic. But that's for another time. So, yeah, I came to this program 6 years ago as director of the No Animals Were Harmed, and I've loved it. It's, you know, going back to my story of what inspired me to be a vet, The Black Stallion, right, a movie, I really feel like I've sort of come full circle, right, in my journey. I'm now protecting animals on film sets. And, it's neat work. So I have a staff of about 60. We're based in Studio City there in Los Angeles, and about 10 internal staff that do accounting and registration and so forth. And
do you have a fundraiser that I can get involved with?
Yeah, we are a charity. We're under the American Humane umbrella, so we're a big national charity. American Humane owns the No Animals Were Harmed program, and we're a charitable organization ourselves. So, we do run on donations, but we also get a grant from SAG-AFTRA to run the program. But, I have about 50 safety reps. We call them certified animal safety reps. They go through some pretty rigorous training to become a safety rep. And those 50 safety reps I have stashed around the world because, you know, as you know, they're making movies around the world. And then I will just dispatch them to these movie sets and they'll be there for the entire run of the set. So if Steven Spielberg is making War Horse in the UK, which took about 3 months, I will have a safety rep there overseeing the action and making sure the horses are kept safe throughout the entire time.
Oh, that's fantastic. We're talking to the great Dr. Quan Stewart, my favorite veterinarian in town. Tell us a little bit about what being a street vet means and your passion for taking care of animals who are with homeless people.
Yeah, this is something I sort of stumbled on when I was working at the shelter and seeing and witnessing a lot of these lower income people unable to get care for their pets. So one day I said, you know what, I'm just going to go out in the community and set up a little clinic. So I just set up my own little table. My girlfriend and my son were my assistants, and it was sort of in the bad part of town where we had homeless population, people living under the bridge and so forth. And I just, anyone who had a pet, I'd sort of invite them over and, you know, vaccinate or clean ears, treat fleas, whatnot. And I loved it. This is years ago. So rewarding. And I said, I'm going to take it one step further. I'm going to pack up a little bag of tricks, right? It was a little tiny Coleman bag and put some meds in there, my stethoscope and otoscope. And I'm just going to walk the streets. I'm going to take the care directly to them because a lot of times these people don't know where they can get free care. And there is free care out there at times, depending on the city you're in. And just find them and sit with them, treat their pets and get to know them a little bit. And that's what I did. I just started walking the streets looking for pets and homeless people. And it turned into, funny thing, when I took the job at Hollywood, it developed into a television show called The Street Vet. And we wrapped production about 7-8 months ago, where I walked the streets of a lot of our major urban cities here in California. So I did L.A. and San Diego and San Francisco and Sacramento. And I Dr. Clapper, I got the most amazing stories from these people, right?
Oh, my God.
I got to sit with them. And there's this sort of immediate bond that forms between them and myself. And a lot of times we're reticent at first, right? They don't know why I'm approaching them, and they get hassled a lot, right? The police move them off their spot and tell them to fold their tent. And, you know, unfortunately, there's still people that spit at them and throw things at them. And sometimes they weren't sure I was approaching them. But when they knew I was there for their pet and we had a moment to sit, they would just open up and, you know, share some amazing stories. And here's what I've learned. I think about 40, 50 years ago, a lot of people on the streets were there primarily because of mental illness or drug abuse. But today, it's more economic.
Wow.
A lot of people on the streets because they just have a hard time bringing in enough money to get, say, an apartment, a decent apartment in L.A. I met a young lady who was all of 32 years old, pretty young lady who had a master's degree, was living on the streets with her little doggy. And it sends a strong message, but it's been a wonderful experience for me.
Where can people learn more about what you're up to? Do you have a website? Is there someplace that we can look to any of these activities that you do?
Yeah, so I do most of my posting, and it, you know, sometimes I go a week or so without updating people, but they can follow me on Instagram at Dr. Kwan. So D R K W A N E. My first name is actually spelled Kwan, even though it looks like Quain. So D R K W A N E, and then at the Street Vets on Instagram, and I'll post little stories and pictures and updates there.
All right. Well, it was such a treat to be able to talk to you, and thank you once again personally for taking care of me. And I look forward to the next time, Kwan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Doc. Okay. Yeah, thank you so much. Pleasure knowing you.
Okay, same here. The great Dr. Kwan Stewart. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show here on ESPN LA 710. This is the Rolling Stones, Under My Thumb. And right now you get to walk under Shaquille O'Neal. And I'm talking right now to the two beautiful artists that created this sculpture, Omri Amrani and Julie Rotblatt. Fellas, here in the booth, this is like got to be one of the greatest days. I want to thank you guys for joining us, Julie and Omri. This is just amazing. Tell us about music. Does music play a part at all in your work, or do you work silently?
Yeah, I always have the radio on or my tunes from my phone that is on. It definitely helps me work. It gives me a rhythm. Sometimes I also listen to lectures as well. Listen to Alan Watts. You know, I like to listen to different philosophies as well. But music, Philip Glass, Bonnie Raitt, the Rolling Stones. I don't know. You know, huge variety. Bob Dylan.
Wow. And Omri, how about you?
Well, with me, it's more complicated. I'll tell you, in the 60s, we had this bomb shelter in the kibbutz that I painted the entire walls and the ceiling and turned it into a disco.
The Bee Gees, huh? You're listening to the Bee Gees.
No. Carlos Santana. all the way, and I'm still trying to reach him to make a sculpture for him. But I'll tell you about the story that indirect is pretty much, I was on a flight to China for exhibition in Shanghai in 2000. And in that time, the airplane, it was pretty empty. So I took four seats and turned it to my studio. Focused all the light in the center, put the music in my ear, and I had to do 12 drawings for the Will Chamberlain sculpture. Man. So I was working all night long on, you know, out of time. I had to put a lot of pressure, and basically I bounced with the music into the pencil. And in the middle of the night, I raised my head up, and there's about 40 people standing there like ghosts watching me working. And I tried to explain to them that I'm on time. I got to finish 12 drawings and send to Philadelphia to start the Will Chamberlain project there for the stadium. And, you know, I was like frantic working with the music, very hyper because of the music making you hyper, so the pencil is run much faster, and you have those 40 ghosts just standing there. Yeah. What are you doing it? In the middle of the fucking ocean.
Can I tell you a Will Chamberlain story? He was a patient of mine. I did his hip surgery in the 90s, and he's 7'1". We don't have a prosthesis that will be that big. So I made him get a CAT scan, not just an x-ray of his hip. And I took the CAT scan, sent it to Indiana where they have a computer that took the CAT scan and built an actual model in plexiglass of his hip so they could then build a prosthesis to fit it. And I still have, technically, Will Chamberlain's hip because I have the plexiglass of exactly what his hip is. And one day if I get to meet you, which will be a real honor, I will show you an actual hip of a typical adult, and then you will look at the hip of Will Chamberlain, and it looks like a dinosaur bone. It's incredible. You would particularly get a kick out of this. So let me ask you, do you guys have a favorite sculptor? Is someone in your past that inspired you? Is it Michelangelo? Is it Rodin? Is there someone that really that motivated you as a child to say, yes, this is what I want to do with my life?
When I went to Italy in the 80s and I went to Rome and I was in the museums, I think that, yes, Michelangelo was one of the stars. that I looked up to, but also Bernini, I have to say, really floored me.
Yes.
Because the amount of time that he spent on his marbles, and they are so alive.
Yes, yes.
So full of emotion and tension and realism. But, you know, I also do abstract work, too, which plays off of my foundation of classicism.
Hmm.
So I do reflect the art world of today as well, my work. And I think that's important because an artist does reflect the era that they live in, because they have to speak of what the issues are of today.
You know? I agree.
The digital world, the computer runs our life, you know, it's... We can't just live in the 1500s again. So, but that was both Omri and my basis for learning art. We learn the basics, and we still do it, and we still implement it. But we also have our other ideas that we reflect in today's world as well.
Well, I just love how much you work on anatomy, and that's the beauty of me as a surgeon. There are surgeries that I do now that I didn't learn 30 years ago in my training. You have to, you're right, keep current. But the beautiful thing is, Julie, the body doesn't change. The anatomy that you guys work on does not change. And what I love the most is how you, in all the different sculptures that you've done, you play with the anatomy to tell a story. And just like Omri says, you have a moment, you have an instant. How are you going to show a whole person's life in just an instant? You know, when Michelangelo had to make the life of Lorenzo de' Medici, he loved him, his patron, he made the four times of day, because in the end, your life is just like a single day. What you guys are doing is even better than that. You're making an entire person's life in a single sculpture. That's what's so special about you guys.
You know, what you say is so true. We just talked about this yesterday. This month we're married 30 years, and it's looking like one long day.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to tell you also, there is a place in Italy that I would recommend to all of your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Cemetery of Staniello in Genoa.
Really?
It is a mountain of mausoleums of sculptures that's done in the last 200 years before the electricity and into the pneumatic and electricity era.
Hmm.
And it's a phenomenal place. If you walk over there, you take with you breakfast and lunch and a bottle of wine, you go up to the hill and you start to go down slowly, slowly between all the structure. There are thousands of amazing artwork that's done in marble, and that is, it's phenomenal. It's one place in the world that combine all what you are talking about.
So I just want to leave you with a thought. I'm curious what your thoughts are about it. In Michelangelo's sculpture in the Vatican, the Pietà, Jesus is an adult, Mary holding her son who's passed away. She tilts her head away from him, and her eyes are closed. In the Pietà that's in Florence, in the Medici Chapel, he makes another Pietà, only here Mary, again, is an adult, holding Jesus as a baby, who she knows she's going to be losing. Here, for emotion, he turns her head towards the baby, and her eyes are open. These subtle, complicated emotions depicted in his work. Is that what blows you away about him? What is it that blows you guys away about Michelangelo?
I think it's mostly his dedication. I think that what he allowed him to tell to himself, to tell to the world, this is what I can do. I can take your emotion and put it in the stone for you to be sharing and admiring. But then towards the end of his life, he said, you see those four slaves who are coming out from the rock? It's the glimpse. It's just the suggestions which you have to build your dream into. And it's kind of goes deeper. It's like the Shaquille O'Neal. It's the quest.
I think that the amount of emotion that he was able to convey through his marbles and his paintings as well, the Sistine Chapel, I mean, he was so multi-talented to be able to switch from sculpture to painting, and the amount of work that that man created during his time. And he was also an architect and a poet as well. And so I guess the veracity of his work, the intellect, the he was a true Renaissance man.
I want to leave you with something to think about.
Yes.
The artist that we call the Renaissance man, Leonardo da Vinci, left behind him only 12 paintings. And he being considered the most artist of mankind. Just because of his books of rendering and analysis and research and mostly failure. Most of his failures were became the success of today. And this man is the Renaissance man, and all what he left behind is only 12 paintings.
That's amazing. You're right. Listen, the two of you, I could talk for hours. It's just you have become like a booster shot for all of us, because in the end, no matter what you do for a living, I'm a surgeon, maybe an electrician is listening or a computer person, the greatest thing you can do with your life is to be an artist. And the two of you, you walk the walk and you talk the talk. And I really want to thank you so much for making time. You've enriched our whole day here in Los Angeles. Thank you both very much.
It was very interesting talking with you.
All right. All right. Toda raba.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Have a great day. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show every Saturday morning. Richard, thanks so much for making time. I know it's early in the morning.
No, don't. That's a misconception right off the bat, Dr. C. Okay, I don't. You know, I'm a. You know, and these people, I've been listening to you for years.
Get out of here.
Service. And for a hype, and for a weekend warrior like I am, after your show, I'm so drained. I feel like putting myself into a mental institution. I love the help you give to other people. Yeah. I even dream in clap revision. Everything you've in a way you've. You're like the Messiah for people like us. And on the other hand, you make us immobile.
You're
we're
too
afraid
kind.
To walk out. We go and we fix a drain. We slip. You know, all of a sudden, we're on the phone with you. And then we're coming in for a pre-op. And then you're telling us what machines to go under. It's a great service. And yet, for me, it's been a nightmare. So take care.
I appreciate it immensely.
No, what a great show. I'm glad you made it safely back. Congratulations on the wedding.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And good luck getting some guests.
Yeah.
Seriously. You ever get, when you get weddings like that, you know, no, I know it's, look, they like, there's a little, it's a little rooftop place, it's near Tibet.
Have you been to Switzerland?
No, I haven't been because I've always been upset with their neutrality. They're too indecisive for me. Should we go to war? I don't know. Let's think about it. It's unfair. It's unfair in terms globally. It's unfair. But
no, it's great.
But I'm an art freak like you are, and I can't get enough of Italy, like you said. And
how fair is the analogy, Richard? I sculpt. I go to Italy every summer, specifically go to the quarry where Michelangelo got the stone for the David, because I'm obsessed with that as a vocation for myself, to carve in marble.
Being a surgeon, it's perfect.
It's perfect. But how am I being crazy in the sense that it's similar to comedy? I am crazy. I worked in the Catskill Mountains. We can get into that in a second. That's how I paid for medical school. But to be able to remove the stone, to see the figure that's hidden inside the rock, different than additive art like drawing, painting, or clay. But as a comedian, you sit down with a piece of paper and a pen, and then do you carve away the excess words to get to the punchline with the minimum amount of words?
Well, listen. I'm not going to. It's a long list of comedians that people love and don't love. You know, I can't say a Gallagher to a Lenny Bruce or a Mort Zoll. I'm not putting them down, but like, I'm not sure if you said should I hit a cassava melon or a watermelon and spend a sleepless night. But if you compare that kind of figuring it out to say. George Carlin, and I'm not being specific yet about your question, but like George Carlin and I worked very differently. When I was a younger comic, I've been doing this like 46 years, and I did so many specials, you had to make sure you had like a 55-minute set that was perfect. So you had to go on the road and do basically these jokes every night in the same order so the studio can see it. I mean, you know, the mm-hmm. cable network and the director. And that's the only way to make it perfect. And that's just the overall set. Hmm. But I got bored doing that all after 20 years, and I said, I just want to just free associate like you do, basically, on mm-hmm. the air. And I have thousands, like 20, 30 hours of material in my... Now, let me be more specific. You asked a very important question. How do you write a joke? And the idea versus the, for a comedy, it's mm-hmm. called the premise. The premise is what's gold. The punchline is what most comics play around with on stage to find the best punchline. Mm-hmm. Like, for an example, I'll give you an example. I remember, for me, it comes differently. I never sat down a day in my life to write a joke I did anywhere on stage. I keep a piece of paper with me, a pad, and I write down something that strikes me funny. Mm-hmm. Here's an example. Like, 30 years ago, I remember it was Tom Brokaw said, Hallie's Comet is due, and I went, Hallie? I said, I've been calling it Haley my entire life. And then I wrote down, what else don't I know? And that was the premise.
Wow.
So then I just, luckily, this stuff sort of pours out of me, whether it's stupid or not, and I said, what else don't I know? Have I been going to, say, a pizzeria and saying, give me a slice of puzza with anchovies? And that was the punchline.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so that, you know, that would get a laugh, you know. Or, so, in other words, for when you look at Michelangelo, I think he was very famous, correct me if I'm wrong, that he would see the sculpture in the block, and he already envisioned it, and his goal was to carve a way to get to that gold, that beautiful.
His biographer, Vasari, one of the few people he let visit him in his studio, said watching him work was as though a woman was nude underneath the water in a bath, and all he did was pull the drain, and as the water receded, the figure appeared. What a visual. That's how he worked. He could see that figure, and all he was doing was removing the excess stone. It's an amazing... And Vasari then blurted out, he said, well, how do you know when to stop? And Michelangelo, pretty obnoxious, turns to him and says, when you hit the skin. Some tough.
I hope you don't say that in the opera.
But you know, I was
listening to you today. You know, because you're so brilliant, and you really all the acclaim you get is worthy for sure. And but you know, I was saying, you know, if you're not entirely out from the anesthesia, you know, you're not supposed to, and you're here, and you're going, all right, give me this, and suture that up. You know, I saw Monet's. I was right. You move it over a little bit. He's unbelievable. I prefer Gauguin in a lot of ways, and of course, this is Richard Lewis. So let's get some expressionistic work going on here with Monk. And I mean, you're so in tune with your work, and you mentioned that doctor that you probably studied under in
Manawat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he was a kingpin when I was growing up in New York, you know. And
I remember seeing you. You don't remember meeting me, but I actually remember going to make rounds.
You were sitting in the corner mumbling about Switzerland.
No, in the 80s, I was there. You were visiting some friend of yours at the hospital for special surgery.
Right.
And I remember seeing you then.
A woman who had many, many surgeries, and you know, it's sort of ironic that I would speak to you for the first time today because I was on my way to start a 3-month tour about 2.5 months ago, and foolishly, waiting for the car to take me to the airport, I decided for no real reason to go on one of these little roofs I have in the house to check a drain.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, I'm in my 60s now, and you got to really, not because I'm in my 60s, but there was a safe way to lower myself down and a stupid quick way.
Ugh.
I stood on top of this, it was 4 feet, 5 feet high, rather than sit on it and just lower myself down and put my weight on my feet, look at the drain, do the same thing, lift myself up and then go into the house. I jumped. I mean, I slipped standing up, and I felt full pressure on my wrist, on my head. I whipped my shoulder, and as it turned out, my head was fine, thank God.
Thank God.
And I tore a little bit of my rotator, which I just need rehab for, but I severely broke my wrist.
Oh, boy.
And that's kept me off the road for 2 months. I wanted to ask you a question, actually.
Sure.
It's doing great, and if you don't, and I've spoken to so many people that don't really follow through with rehab, and then, you know, they're Fist looks like something that would be the sequel to Frankenstein. It's their fault. You know, you really got to do your therapy, right, Doc? Otherwise,
you do.
You know, even as good as the operation is, you're not taking. You know, you got to show up with your own shovel and do the work yourself.
Well,
so I've been doing that religiously. You know, and I have all these crazy little things I can do with my wrist for mobility. Like, and I'll do it unconsciously now. If I go out to dinner now and I don't have to wear the brace anymore,
mm-hmm.
I'll be putting my chin on my wrist and bending it down, and people look at me oddly. But, you know, I don't care. I mean, it's all
right.
About getting healthy again. And
did they put plates and screws in your wrist?
Plates and screws, like Frankenstein.
All right. So let me give you a clapper vision of what happened to you.
I dream in clapper vision, by the way. I was once making out with Sophia Loren at the top of the Spanish Steps. You were watching, and you came over, and you weren't impressed at all with Sophia. And you went, your knee, look at that knee. I think you need to get an MRI.
No. So
you really invaded my life, but that's okay. Give me some ideas about the screw. I mean, these are going to stay in forever.
Yes, because you're in your 60s. If you were in your 20s, then you could argue about taking them out. But if they're in your 60s, you can leave them alone. They're inert. It's like a filling in your tooth. The challenge for the orthopedic surgeon, though, is when you break a bone, let's pretend you broke your forearm. We worry about two things. Will it heal? And will it heal in the right position, the right rotation, the right angulation? That's what we worry about when fractures occur in the mid-shaft. So think of your bone as a yellow pencil. When you snap the pencil in the shaft, two things. Will it heal? And will it heal in the right position? But when you fracture where the eraser is, then we worry about a third thing, which is arthritis, because now you are actually changing the overall alignment of the cartilage where the two bones in the joint are touching each other, and that's the challenge. The plate and the screws is the equivalent of you taking that coffee table that has four legs and it's a flat surface, and you jumped on top of it.
You're a genius, but go on. Go on. Finish up.
And you shattered the legs of the table. Uh-huh. But not only shattering the legs, but you also crack the top of the coffee table. Orthopedic surgery.
Can I have some more oxygen? Thank you. Dr. Clapper, can I stop you for a second? This is why people listening who love you, and I do too, when you're nervous and you're going and you finally get an appointment with hopefully, you know, with a good orthopedic surgeon, say.
Right.
You don't have much time. The waiting room, it's like a subway ride. It's an E-train in New York. And you know that the guy's busy or the woman's busy and they have maybe an operation in an hour. And, you know, you make notes before. You're sweating. You know, I got these questions. That's why I usually bring between 20 and 30 friends with me. Listen to Dr. Clapper. Because we're going to ride home. No, he said it's like a coffee bean, not a coffee table. No. He says you'll remove the mug, then he'll put it in a ceramic kiln. No, he says you could die if you kill. And then if you ask most doctors again, they go, you know, the nurse comes in or the assistant. We have someone waiting.
Richard, my favorite is elderly Jewish couples when the poor husband, he's married 60 years, he needs his knee replaced. He's sitting on the exam table. I look and I go, Murray? When does it hurt? Not a word comes out of Murray's mouth. The wife goes, it kills him at night. He can't sleep at night. I have to now have the whole conversation with the wife. Murray has been taught never to speak. It's hilarious.
Well, listen to me. You know, is this good? I had a hernia again, but this time I knew. And this is like 2 weeks after my operation with my wrist. It's like 6 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the first time, I never had a hernia. I was on the road. In the middle of nowhere in Florida in a concert hall and and I'm there the night before and I see this bump down there in the groin area.
Yeah, yeah.
And I leap right to, I'm dead. About a week. Now, you have to know that I was 90 minutes from the Tampa airport and I wasn't going to call anybody because I was afraid to hear the bad news.
Never get sick in Florida. Never have surgery in Florida, Richard.
No, but I wasn't, believe me, where I was, it would have been, it would have been not Western medicine where I was. I wasn't going to see anybody. It was a very odd venue. So the deal is, I don't call my wife, who has much, much more positive about these kind of things. And I would have said to her, because I thought it was, I hate saying it, I thought it was a tumor.
Right.
And she would have said, "Oh, stop it," she said. She would have said, made up any, she would have said, like, you had an Italian restaurant we went to in Burbank that we disliked, and I just saw online that if you don't like this meatballs, or if it's a bad meatball, it could lodge in your thigh or in your groin area. And I would have to live with that ridiculous Aesop's fable all the way back to Los Angeles. So I didn't tell anybody until I went right to see my doctor the next morning, and he says, it's hernia. Boom, bangs. Thank you, ma'am. So listen, doctor, I have this broken wrist. It's healing, and I saw an X-ray last week, and the doctor, great. I'm not going to name names.
I know them all.
I know. Of course you know. This is great, great. But he showed me where the two bones had there was like a white space, I believe. He says, we have to wait for those bones to... He didn't say the word fuse, obviously, but,
right.
but I, apparently I have to wait for those things so that you don't see that space between. What
Correct.
Was I looking at?
So let me give you a clapper vision, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So when your bone breaks, the first thing that happens is you get bleeding, like you cut your skin. That bleeding that you see when you cut your skin is liquid. So that's like apple juice. With time, you know that your bleeding becomes a clot. It congeals. So you start to develop a clot. This is all happening under the microscope. It literally becomes like chocolate pudding. So you now have chocolate pudding in between the bone fragments. You can't see that on an X-ray. Still looks like a space.
Right.
Your body has cells, like little mafia guys doing surveillance, running around your body in your bloodstream.
You know, I've been sober for 22 years, but it's the first high I've had.
So you
keep going. I'm writing this. My wife's writing notes.
So now you have these cells in your body that have little berets on them and telescopes going around surveillance in your bloodstream looking for chocolate pudding. When these cells see chocolate pudding, like your fractured wrist, these cells, they're called fibroblasts, jump on top of the chocolate pudding and hold hands, kind of like those guys who jump out of airplanes. I still don't understand why.
I'm shocked you went that far out with that metaphor.
So they're all holding hands as they're holding hands as they're going to before the parachute goes off. Basically, these cells team up and land on top of the chocolate pudding, these fibroblasts, and now they start leaking from their cells pasta. They start making collagen fibers that basically surround the chocolate pudding like an Italian fisherman threw a fishing net on top of the chocolate pudding. You still can't see the fishing net or the chocolate pudding on the X-ray. Now you have other cells that are circulating. These are French guys going through your bloodstream, and they see the fishing net. They are looking for fishing net. They're French fishermen. These cells are looking for fishing nets, and they're called osteoblasts. What they do is they put calcium and mineral on top of fishing nets. Until you are more than 30% of what you have as the blood clot, as the fishing net, when it's less than 30%, we don't see it on the X-ray as a white line or calcium. When you get beyond 30% of the fishing net is calcified, we call it callus, then we can see on the X-ray the healing bone that it's being glued together, and then we know you're on the mend of having this weld together. So that's what they're waiting for. You still have a black line, the space between the bones, because that's chocolate pudding with fishing net, less than 30% calcified. But once that day occurs, where you now see it become white, where it fills in, then you know you have enough healed callus, then you're really done. And how long does it take? You know, most bones take 6 weeks, but I'm going to tell you, your wrist will not feel normal for 18 months.
18 months, yeah, I was told something like that. And I think my stickball days are over because I would listen to you for years at an undisclosed, driving to an undisclosed field. I used to play stickball in New York.
I love to play stickball in New York. Listen, I used to also work in the Catskill Mountains. The Homowack, the Gilberts, probably places you ran around to many times.
No, that's a little bit before my time.
Really?
Really. You know, I was in New York and Greenwich Village and, you know, the improv and all that stuff.
Richard, I want to talk sports with you, though, because we know you're such a huge sports fan, and we know
the Knicks are doing great. You know, are they still? You know, I'm a New Yorker.
Right.
So, I mean, let's just establish that, you know. I'm a New
Yorker. We're not fooling anybody.
We're out here. Any New York team, you know, a New York, the Korean New York ping pong team, I'm for.
What about the Golden State Warriors? Can't you appreciate their greatness?
Oh, God. I mean, I've been a basketball freak, you know, my entire life. And, you know, you get to a point where I just, you know, maybe it's age, you know. It's like you've seen so much, or you hope, if you're lucky enough to live that long.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to have seen Wilt and then have Wilt see me as a fan, you know, it's like pretty trippy and surreal. Mm-hmm. I won't go there, but it's, you know, like every dream, my dreams have caught up with my reality. So now it's like rather than root for teams, although I still have rooting interest, but less so. But watch, I now can watch entire games. It's like a painting watching those backcourt play and watching that Seth. That it, you know, it's, you know, this is a once in a lifetime, once in a generational kind of deal with that guy, and just like I was watching San Antonio for years. And I hope he gets a chance to go up against LeBron. That's, you know, I really think it would be great.
Well, it's, you can hear all the crossfires.
It's a beauty, the Warriors. It really is.
It is a thing. We've never seen anyone shoot the basketball like Steph
no
Curry.
No one like this guy. And it reminds me, I used to, you know, young people, you should see any tapes of the old, when the New York Knicks won their championships in 70 and 73, the way they worked the ball around and the way they were a complete unit was a thing of beauty as well. And there were other teams, of course. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, let's not.
Are you a Jets fan or a Giants fan?
Huh?
Are you a Jets fan or a Giants fan?
Well, again, I was always a Jets and a Mets fan because I grew up, and I told this, I wrote about Vin Scully in a book, The Other Great Depression, about my recovery and how I, when I was 5 years old, I was listening to him on the radio. And then when I moved out here in the 70s, there was that voice.
Right.
And then I got a chance to write about him and speak to him about Gil Hodges, why he never got into the Hall of Fame with all his numbers and everything, because I was a big Gil Hodges fan. Mm-hmm. And I wound up emailing and speaking to one of his daughters, and she went, oh, we've given up on it. You know, I'm sorry. You know, because you think in your own mind everyone has as much passion, and you know. But she said, no, we, you know, after so many years, they don't want to hear about it. You know, people bemoaning Gil Hodges. And you look up his numbers, guys, if you're a baseball stat freak or women. The guy deserved it. He had the same kind of numbers as Cepeda and those guys. Anyway, well, I'm getting off track. You ever get off track, Doctor?
Never.
And by the way, what you said, I've already taped, and it's getting going down. You're the only guy whose monologues need to be sent to a lab. To be worked up. And I'm afraid what you just told me, my wife taped it, she's bringing it to my internist, and he's going to send it out with my urine and my blood. And if I come back with any bad news from your rap, you know, I'll be very depressed.
All right, Richard. Thanks so much for making time.
You're tremendous. You really are. We're really blessed to have you, buddy.
Well, I appreciate it very much, Richard. God bless. Have a great day. All right. That was the great Richard Lewis. What a pleasure.